Good morning, Your Honors, and congratulations, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you.
My name is Joseph Peter Drennan, and I have the distinct privilege and high honor of representing my client, E.E. Mart, F.C., LLC, in these proceedings. We would like to, if we could, reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
Your Honors, this is a fairly straightforward assignment of error based upon the erroneous application of Section 8.01-271.1 of the Code of Virginia by the Circuit Court of Fairfax County. Essentially, this is the statute that allows a circuit court judge to award sanctions under certain circumstances, and litigation initiated for an improper purpose. That really has not been asserted here. The record doesn't bear that out. Or pleadings or positions taken in the litigation that are frivolous. And that is the contention that my learned opposing counsel asserted below and is asserting here. And respectfully, Your Honors, one, the litigation, the subject litigation, was not frivolous. Two, under the objective reasonableness standard, which governs the review of the circuit court decision here, the assessment of an award of sanctions does not meet that standard. Let's talk about the litigation first. What is meant by the litigation? Well, these parties had a long and rather complicated bout of litigation that started in the Circuit Court of Fairfax County, a suit brought by my client against Ms. De Leon and her companies that was later non-suited. That was one discrete action. Then my client initiated suit in Maryland against Ms. De Leon and her related companies and the Travelers Insurance Company, a case that was removed by Travelers to the U.S. District Court, later remanded back to the Circuit Court of Carroll County. And then, while that was going on, Ms. De Leon initiated a declaratory judgment action in Fairfax County that is the subject litigation that we're dealing with. And my client filed a counterclaim against Ms. De Leon. As it happened, my client, an LLC, was bereft of counsel to present its counterclaim and defend against the declaratory judgment action because in the summer of 2013, my client's counsel had withdrawn from the case. So, as the case matured for trial, my client was essentially in a position of default, not having filed an exhibit list and a witness list in comportance with the court order, the scheduling order. And because my client did not appear with counsel at the scheduled trial date, my client was not in a position to cross-examine the witnesses and evidence adduced by the FLEs here. And as a consequence, the circuit court judge was left with a default situation. He treated the counterclaim as having been abandoned. He essentially granted the declaratory judgment action based upon a very short presentation of proof involving a series of leading questions and affirmative answers, and then deigned upon the invitation of counsel to award sanctions under 8.01-271.1, not against the attorneys, the several attorneys, several law firms in two jurisdictions, three jurisdictions if you count the federal matter, but against my client, the LLC, only. That being the case, it appears that my client was basically subjected to a routine grant of sanctions because it was in default. There is no indication whatsoever that the court conducted any kind of exacting inquiry as to why the attorneys filed the allegations that they did, etc. Instead, there was silence from my side because of the default, and the court proceeded to award sanctions. The sanctions award is flawed for that reason. It's also flawed because the court exceeded the bounds of its jurisdiction. One, the antecedent action, the non-suit action, was a distinct case. There was no motion for sanctions under 8.01-271.1 made in respect of that case. Yet, the court deigned to award sanctions based on that case, a separate, distinct case.
Let me ask a question about your assignment of error, counsel. Your assignment of error specifically calls out the Court of Carroll County, Maryland proceeding and the United States District Court for the District of Maryland proceeding. Does your assignment of error question the court's ability to award sanctions on the non-suited case?
It does because of the use of inter alia, meaning among other things, that this order, and the court speaks through its orders, was erroneous on manifold grounds, and perhaps this particular assignment of error was inartfully stated, and I apologize for that to the court, but I do believe that this assignment of error does preserve that issue for this honorable court.
Counsel, let me just make sure I understand your answer. You're conceding, or at least for purposes of argument, that if the words inter alia were not in your assignment of error, it might be fatally flawed.
As regards the award of sanctions based upon the non-suited action, I don't make that concession. I just say that it's good that I said
that.
If
one were to argue that your assignment of error is insufficient, your response is the term inter alia moves it over into the sufficient category.
Yes, among other things. Among other things. This order was erroneous for a whole host of considerations.
I understand your position.
Now,
suppose for a moment.
Yes.
If there was a concerted effort, not your client, hypothetical, concerted effort by a plaintiff to harass a particular defendant, and they were to do so by filing similar, indeed identical, lawsuits in all 50 states, and then they picked one case in Virginia and said, we would like to present the sanctions motion, and we want to present it including evidence of this pattern of harassment throughout all 50 states, and we were entered in Alaska this way and in Oregon this way, etc. Is it your position that our sanctions statute would not permit the consideration of the pattern of conduct that included filing suits in multiple jurisdictions?
Respectfully, Your Honor, no, I don't believe that it would be a proper consideration because Those lawsuits filed in other jurisdictions are all subject to analogs of this rule in other the other courts of competent jurisdiction to address those questions. And here, this is not that unusual where you have cases in this jurisdiction and a party non-suits and refiles over in the next jurisdiction. But these actions were not initiated simultaneously, as Your Honor's example appears to imply, that there was this blanketing of lawsuits filed across the 50 states. I think that, I'll amend my earlier answer. I think that under those circumstances, if they were filed simultaneously, I think that that is a pattern that might be subjected to consideration. However, what happened here is that these matters were initiated serially. You have one suit that was initiated by my client. It was non-suited. A second suit was filed with no adjudication on the merits. Second suit is filed in Maryland. It winds up in federal court. It's removed to federal court. It's remanded back to state court. No adjudication on the merits in respect to that case. Meanwhile, my opponent, or my client's adversary, Ms. De Leon, files her case in the circuit court asking for a declaratory judgment action to extinguish my client's rights, and he counterclaims in that case, and it's the counterclaim that's alleged to be the action that's repetitive.
If I save some time for rebuttal. You're down to 3 minutes.
I understand, Your Honor. I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Right. Thank you.
3 minutes and 10 seconds.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Jerry Freelander, representing Ms. De Leon, Mr. Chief Justice. I really strongly disagree with my worthy opponent. Certainly, Judge Kasabian went out of his way, if you read the record, to let Mr. Kim, who appeared pro se, try to have a word, ask for a continuance, and in fact had me actually reproduce the opening part of my presentation in evidence and opening statement. So he tried. But unfortunately, E.E. Mark, controlled by Mr. Kim, was abusive. In 2010, they filed the suit, and on they allowed counsel to withdraw in that case, and on the eve of trial, brought in another lawyer. They didn't file a list of witnesses, no exhibits, and so forth. I could do the same thing on these other cases, but counsel raised in his opening remarks here the question of whether it's frivolous. These three cases, whether they were frivolous, and Judge Kasabian found they were frivolous. And when you read all three cases, they all involve the same claim for conversion, the same claim for diversion of funds, the same claim that false entities were created. And the only difference between the counterclaim in our present case and the Maryland's factual pattern alleged there and the first case that was non-suited is the first case didn't say that Mr. Kim didn't own any part of this company and Mr. Leon didn't own it. That's the only difference.
What is your authority for the position that 271.1 authorizes a Virginia court to impose sanctions for a pleading filed in a Maryland court or a Maryland federal court?
The answer to your question is severalfold. We have the Vincent case that I've cited. We have the Carruthers case I've cited from the Virginia Court of Appeals, in which they have dealt with a typical divorce problem.
Vincent where was a collateral attack on a court order, was it not?
Yes, and there were multiple pieces of litigation.
On a Virginia court order from that same court, from that same circuit court.
Yes, ma'am, and the problem they had in those cases were they were separate claims, they were separate cases, and there this one court imposed sanctions for the abuse of the process, putting people to the defense of these other cases. And that's what happened here because, as you know...
But the distinction and what's troubling me is that Vinson was a collateral attack on a proceeding from that circuit court. This is an attack on a proceeding filed in a totally separate sovereign, two totally separate sovereigns.
Well, I would argue...
Did 71 expand that far?
Yes, ma'am, I would like to. I think in the Chbosky case, if I said the name right, I'm sure I didn't. The court had said there are factors and there are choices that a judge has, and it's a function of the power of the circuit court. If you made the decision to impose sanctions because the litigation is frivolous, and that's not under attack at this court. That was not challenged. It's not an issue. Once you've arrived at that point, what can you consider? What factors can you consider?
Considering it is one thing. Considering the filing in the other two jurisdictions for purposes of determining, is this counterclaim before me frivolous? Consider that, but to award sanctions for those other filings. I don't read Vinson or Chbosky or any of the cases to go that far, so help me with that.
The cases, when you read them all together, this is a very common problem around the country. I didn't bring in cases from other states because their sanctions laws are different, and I wanted to stay focused on our statute. But the way I construe this, first a judge has a choice of how to impose a sanction, what type to impose. It has to be reasonable. It's one of the factors. And he can consider what the expense and burden imposed on the parties has been. And that factor would and could include the attorney's fees that those people paid. And in our particular case, the actual affidavit lists all three jurisdictions, breaks it down, so it's broken down. And as the judge could have said, I'm not going to give you for case one, but I'll give you for case two. He could have selected and factored it in because he was given the factual information to do that with. And he elected as a choice to punish. And that's the difference. This is a punishment, it's a sanction, and it's a power that's in the discretion of the trial judge. And my argument is this, that if we take away from the trial judge the discretion to consider what the litigants are burdening each other with, as Your Honor had said, what if they file a suit in every 50 state and then burden them? In one state, they said enough. And that's what I said in this case below.
Well, as you noted, stated here just a minute ago, sanctions statutes are different. Suppose a Virginia judge is going to sanction somebody for something that's not sanctionable in another state.
Well, I suppose if there had actually been a party opposing it, they could argue that that sanction would be unreasonable under those circumstances. And that's why the trial judge is given the broad discretion that the case law appears to have given them, so they can make that assessment. That's really what we're talking about here, is how does the judge choose what's reasonable, what's not reasonable? How does he go about determining the amount of the sanction? And is it an award of attorney's fees because it's a fraud case? Is it an award of attorney's fees because it's a contract case that it provides for it? No. It's punishment for abusing the system. And in the appellate cases that I cited, they were punishing people for prior cases in the General District Court, in the JDR Court, the Appeal to Circuit Court, Appeal to the Court of Appeals. And they're looking at those.
Counsel, how do you explain the last part of the sentence in 271.1? It says he can impose all these sanctions that you're talking about because of the filing of the pleading motion or other paper or making of the motion, including a reasonable attorney fee. I mean, it points specifically to the filing of the pleading motion or other paper. And you're saying in response to Justice Powell's question that part of the statute gives the court the jurisdiction to award sanctions for the filing of a pleading motion or other paper in another state.
My argument, Madam Justice, is that the language also says, and as sanctions, include attorney's fees and other expenses, other costs. And as the Court of Appeals said in one of the cases I cited, that would have no meaning if you couldn't consider the burdens on the parties.
The consideration of the factors and jurisdiction are two different things, like Justice Powell And so you always go back to, let's assume for purposes of the question that we can consider all the states. But the question is, how under this Virginia statute, when it says because of the filing of the pleading motion, you want us to read that statute to say because of the filing of the pleading motion or other paper in any state?
I am not saying that the initial determination of the entitlement to sanction can be because of what happened in another state. I am not saying that. What I'm saying is once Judge Kasabian concluded that the counterclaim was frivolous, and he made that finding, then he could look at what happened in Maryland, which burdened the defendants, as a factor in arriving at a sanction for the frivolous claim because they were the same.
Well, let me ask you this. What did that have to do with the expense incurred because they filed in Virginia? As Justice McClanahan just stated, our statute says that what you're entitled to are reasonable expenses incurred because of the filing of the pleading in our state.
And other expenses. And it's that other expense.
The statute doesn't say that. I don't know what you're looking at, but if you look at 8.01.271.1, it says amount of reasonable expenses incurred because of the filing of the pleading, motion, or other paper, or making of the motion, including a reasonable attorney's fee.
Your Honor, I was looking at Benson versus Benson.
Well, I'm looking at the statute.
Right, and it says, does not limit the court from awarding other expenses as a result of the defending motion, suggesting that other amounts can be included also. Any other reading of that term, other expenses, meaningless.
Other expenses in addition to the attorney's fees related to the filing of the pleading in Virginia. Those other expenses, why wouldn't that be appropriate reading of that?
Because it would limit the court in the selection of the sanctions that would be in the arsenal of sanction choices available to trial judge.
Let me ask a question about your non-suited case, which
yes, ma'am.
Brings us closer to home than the Maryland and the federal. Your non-suited case was over final judgment. The court had lost jurisdiction. No sanctions were requested during
Correct.
The course of that proceeding. How does the court regain jurisdiction to reach back to a non-suited case over which it has lost jurisdiction to impose sanctions for that filing?
I'm making a distinction between an action that violates the rule 1:1, 21-day rule and under 271.1. Under 271.1, the court has, as I said, an arsenal of choices. Expenses or burdens, economic burdens on a party, because this is a continuation of a pattern of frivolous filings, should be something our judges could consider in considering sanctions. They don't have to. They can. And when they look at it, how do they monetize it? And they can monetize it by looking at what the illegal fees or expenses burdened by the party offended were. I argue that in the divorce world, you'll probably see a lot of this. You don't see it in civil cases quite so much, but in the divorce world, we see it. You already have two cases in Virginia. There are cases all over the country where the husband or the wife are filing multiple things over and over and over again. And we need to have a tool that our judges can use. And following the guidelines that I see in the cases this honorable court has decided, you have said the judge has discretion. He can consider the three points, the three factors, and as long as the decision is reasonable in arriving at a sanction as opposed to an award of attorney's fees, which is the distinction I make, as long as he's reasonable in doing that, discretion, it's a subject to abuse of discretion review. And my argument here is this is not an attorney's fee award. It's not going to Maryland and making an award there. It's awarding here for a third filing of the same frivolous claims, and the judge is saying it has to stop, and I'm monetizing the award based on the legal fees.
Why wouldn't the proper way of reading this statute be that you could consider all of those extrajudicial, or at least extraterritorial, cases for the purpose of determining whether or not the party is acting consistently with the requirements of the statute, namely, to the best of his knowledge, information, and belief formed after reasonable inquiry, is well-grounded in fact, warranted by existing law, or a good faith argument for the extension, modification, or reversal, not interposed for any improper purpose, such as to harass, etc., etc. Why isn't that the legitimate reason to add all of the other state proceedings to determine whether that part of the statute is violated? But as many of the justices here, Justice Powell particularly, said, when it comes down to how much it costs, the rule doesn't allow you to go outside of the specific language that the legislature has provided. What did you incur as a result of the making of this motion? Why isn't that a proper way to look at the interpretation of the statute?
There's nothing wrong with the approach that you said, because it doesn't bar the judge from saying, okay, I'm going to award $10,000, I'm going to award $15,000, I think this is a $100,000 case. Now, Judge Thatcher in the Northern Virginia case came up with about $300,000 in sanctions because the attorney and the lawyer had been frivolous in filing these silly claims. What if they had non-suited, instead of going forward with that 3-day trial, refiled, and what could Judge Thatcher have done then? What if the first case had been filed in another jurisdiction and they refiled here? They non-suited there. Could Judge Thatcher have considered the same attorney's fees award? Now, this court had said that the factors that he used were fair and reasonable in arriving at a sanction. And to me, that's the big difference in the arguments. It's not attorney's fees are the only tool available to a trial judge to sanction. It is one of the tools. And arriving at a monetization of what a judge thinks is right is what my argument's all about.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate the time.
Rebuttal.
I understand my time is brief. several points. One, with regard to what could Judge Thatcher have done upon a motion made by the counsel in the initial case, Judge Thatcher could have awarded sanctions if sanctions were appropriate in that case. With regard to the Mr. Chief Justice, your question about considering those other filings in terms of whether it was an intent to harass or otherwise improper, there is no evidence upon the record here that an argument was ever made in that regard, considering the timing of those cases, the posture of those cases. The case in Carroll County had been stayed, for instance.
Well, but your request for relief is that you want a remand in order to determine the amount in a manner that you think is proper.
Actually, Your Honor,
isn't it?
My request is that I believe that the court did not act properly in awarding sanctions in the first place. It did not follow the appropriate protocol. It did not, its putative reasoning did not match the objective reasonableness test. The order is flawed. The order's determination was interlarded with considerations of what was done in other jurisdictions. The finding of frivolousness we challenge as well. It was not listed as a discrete assignment of error, but what happened here was that essentially my client was subjected to sanctions by default, if you like, if I can coin the term, because it was defaulted
Let me help you out here to focus anyway. Suppose on this record we were to decide that the judge was not wrong, did not err in finding that this case was frivolous.
When this case, Your Honor, forgive me for interrupting, but by this case, you mean the counterclaim?
Yes.
All right.
If the record supports that judgment, then what you ask for is a remand for the award of sanctions for determination of the request consistent with the legal standards set forth in the statutory provision. Now, if that's the case, what it is you're asking us to do, if we find that there was the court didn't err in finding that it was frivolous, you're asking us to send it back so that they can put on evidence as to what they're entitled to. Am I right?
Well, Your Honor, I see my time is about to run out of the water clock if I can answer that question. On Your Honor's question, the answer would be yes, but when Your Honor talks about the record, we filed a motion for reconsideration that is part of the record evidence as to that really puts paid to a lot of the issues relating to the court's satisfaction of the evidence in the case, and the court basically turned a blind eye to it and blew it off, and with all due respect to the circuit court, and it's a little troubling if that were to be the finding of the court that it was appropriate to find this counterclaim frivolous based upon the evidence that was fully before the court when it decided denied the motion for reconsideration. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. The court will take a brief recess.
All rise.